This is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, Rome District Chapter, Practice Management Committee. Today is Monday, 9 June, 2014. My name is Clayton Cartwright, the chair of the Practice Management Committee for 2013-2014. We are continuing our podcast today with the podcast entitled A Primer on OFAC and the Export Control Regulations for the Overseas U.S. Immigration Lawyer. I'm here today with Andrew Irvin, who's a partner at Steptoe in D.C. He is our special guest panelist here and will be the focus of our questions today, our basic and very basic high-level questions. I'm also here with my fellow committee members, Lindsay Kershaw and Claire Nelson. Thank you both for coming. Andrew, just to get started here, can you give us a brief? Can you give the chapter a brief introduction of who you are and how your practice relates to their practices?
Sure. Thanks very much, Clay. I'm delighted to join everyone today. I know we have a nice, diverse group of folks located in a lot of places around the world. As Clay said, I'm Andy Irwin. I'm with Steptoe & Johnson LLP. Both in Washington and also in California as well. And I am a international regulatory compliance partner of the firm and handle an assortment of export controls, sanctions, and anti-bribery issues for clients in a number of locales. Historically, you wouldn't necessarily think that export controls and economic sanctions as a legal discipline would overlap all that much with immigration law, but perhaps not so surprisingly, there is a fairly substantial overlay between the two areas of law. I know that today we're primarily going to talk about U.S. economic sanctions promulgated by the U.S. Office of Foreign Asset Control. But even in a pure export control setting, there are a lot of issues. Historically, when someone outside the United States wanted to come to the U.S. as a non-immigrant, not someone who wasn't going to be a citizen or a lawful permanent resident, and they wanted to have a job in the U.S., they might be exposed as a visa holder to a variety of high technology products, services, technical information. And the way that U.S. export control law works is that if you're not a lawful permanent resident, asylee, refugee, or U.S. citizen, and you're exposed to certain technologies, the transfer of that technology to you is considered what's known as a deemed export. It's an export to the country that you're from, in essence. And nowadays, what's happened is that in the last few years, the U.S. authorities have changed the process for getting people certain types of visas in the United States and are requiring their employers to assess the export control status of who comes in under certain visas. It's called an I-129 form. But in any event, what we're going to talk about, I think, more today, and I'll turn it back to Clay in a second, is U.S. economic sanctions. U.S. economic sanctions are not export controls per se, but instead, in essence, financial and service-based controls that the U.S. Implements with respect to variety of actors abroad and a variety of countries abroad. It's kind of tantamount to kind of a U.S. Embargo regime with respect to certain countries. And, you know, the primary examples would be places like Iran and Cuba and Sudan and a couple of others. And there are clearly a number of tricky issues that apply with respect to these sanctions in an immigration context, because in certain circumstances, folks from some of these countries may want to become, you know, get investor visas in the United States and the like, or there could be issues as to whether people of from certain of those countries could be hired in the U.S. at all, or hired by foreign subsidiaries of U.S. Companies or companies otherwise subject to U.S. jurisdiction elsewhere in the world. That's in large measure because in most of these embargo type regimes, there are kind of broad restrictions against providing services to those countries. So if, for instance, you you can't provide a service to Iran, and providing a service to someone who is ordinarily resident in Iran would be providing, in essence, a prescribed service to Iran under these rules. So in any event, there are some exemptions and some carve-outs. The actual phrase in the regs is general license, these general authorizations that you can follow. And there are general licenses not only with respect to Iran, which we'll talk a little bit more about today, for the provision of legal services, which is in Section 525 of the Iran Transactions Regulations, but also there's a general license in Section 505 for activities and services related to certain non-immigrant and immigrant categories and the like. So Clay and others, hopefully that gives a little bit of a overview as to what we might chat about a little bit more this morning.
Sure, and Andy, and thank you for that. It's interesting here. I mean, gone are the days, I think, when someone can just say, "I just practice immigration law," or "I just practice tax law." We're called upon more and more, at least indirectly by our clients, to be familiar with these areas. Not to say we practice in these areas, but to, you know, at least have an idea of when to spot the issues. Now, let's, you know, being that this is the Practice Management Committee, and we go over issues you know, of ethics and other things that are germane to just how we run the practice, I believe that with the regs relating to the Office of Foreign Assets Control, and for those of you listening, when we say OFAC, that's capital O-F-A-C, OFAC, that there are provisions that relate to U.S. persons who practice as lawyers. And I would imagine our overseas colleagues who are mainly practicing U.S. immigration law, you know, would want to be particularly aware of that. Andy, can you sort of provide, I guess, a few bullet points there for what those individuals should be aware of?
If you're subject to the jurisdiction of OFAC, and that can be broader than you might expect, and probably a topic for another call as to all the twists and turns, but if you're subject to the U.S. Treasury Department's jurisdiction, as I said, particularly with respect to a country like Iran, you can't provide services. Now, there are exceptions for that. One of them is the provision of certain legal services. Notice that the reg says certain legal services. So, for instance, if you are subject to U.S. jurisdiction and you're a lawyer, you couldn't, for instance, without a specific license from OFAC, in other words, you're applying to OFAC to be allowed to do something, you couldn't assist an Iranian entity with respect to a commercial transaction. You can't really give kind of purely commercial advice. There are carve-outs in the provision of legal services general license, and I'm going to read portions of them because I think it's relevant, because there is some advice that can be given that relates to dealing with Iran or Iranians. One of them is the provision of legal advice and counseling on requirements of and compliance with laws of the United States and or any jurisdiction within the United States, provided that such advice and counseling is not provided to facilitate transactions in violation of this part. So, for instance, if I'm a U.S. lawyer I'm dealing with a multinational corporation and they want to know whether something they've done does or doesn't run afoul of the Iran regs, and they want to ensure that they are complying with the regs, I can advise on the nature of their any interactions that they might have, but I'm giving compliance advice rather than kind of transactional advice. There are also various carve-outs for purposes of various types of litigation and the like. But the bottom line, in a very simplistic sense, in a very thorny area, so I would suggest to people that anyone who is in this should not think of this podcast as this podcast, number one, isn't legal advice, and number two, is not definitive as to facts and circumstances. But the very high-level understanding is that compliance advice is generally going to be okay. advice that dips the toe into commercial areas is not going to be typically. But the interesting point, though, is that with respect to immigration law, it's not simply a matter of the Section 560.525 provision of legal services portion of the Iran regs, but instead a 560.505, which as I said before, says activities and services related to certain non-immigrant and immigrant categories. And if you look at Part A2 of that, it says U.S. persons are authorized to export services to Iran. So remember, I said before, you couldn't export services to Iran absent there being a license. It says U.S. persons are authorized to export services to Iran in connection with filing of an individual's application for the non-immigrant visa categories listed in paragraph A1 of this section. And it goes on, if you look at the preceding paragraph, which I won't read for purposes of the webcast, certain types of visas, the paperwork associated with them, assistance in connection with filing of those applications is specifically authorized by Section 560.505 of the Iran regs. Now that doesn't cover every category of visa. Notably, the sections there that it specifies don't include investor visas. Investor visas have been trickier because investor visas involve financial transactions as well, and they've historically been more of an area of difficulty, often requiring lawyers to obtain specific licenses to help folks get those visas. The rules on that have changed a bit, and I'm happy to discuss that more in a moment if you'd like, but I'll turn it back to you for a second.
Hey, thanks about that, Andy. Sorry about that little sound in the background. But, yes, I'm going to turn – it's really, really interesting here. And Claire, actually, she's sort of uniquely positioned here because she's one of our few members who is who's not a U.S. national who practices overseas. And so I'm going to turn the podium over to her. Claire.
Thank you, Clayton. So, hi, Andy. I am a U.S. licensed attorney, but as Clayton said, I'm neither a U.S. citizen nor a green card holder. I'm based outside of the United States, and I work for an organization that has offices in the United Kingdom and in Australia, but interestingly, nobody in the United States. Do I have to be concerned at all with OFAC, or am I in the interesting position that OFAC might actually put me at a competitive advantage to my U.S. citizen colleagues who practice U.S. immigration law outside the U.S.?
Well, I can't provide you advice on your circumstances, but what I can say is that I think that there are any number of activities that you might undertake that might conceivably make you subject to your U.S. jurisdiction, including actions taken in the United States, certain interactions you might have with financial institutions and things like that. So I'm not willing to give you a free pass at the moment.
You're playing with...
As you would expect, I couldn't possibly, in a podcast like this, tell a lawyer operating outside the United States that our government doesn't have some capacity to go after.
Indeed.
I suspected as much, but you would have to admit it was worth a try.
Yeah,
right. And to be clear, Andy's right. I mean, a few times here he's mentioned, procedurally, he's definitely correct. I mean, nothing in these podcasts are construed to it as advice to anyone who's listening or anyone happens to listen, even the intended audience. So this is all just high-level discussions and information that's being provided. And, I would suspect as much as well. But, again, I think the question certainly is worth asking.
The question is worth asking. I can say at a high level, certainly someone who is not a U.S. person, who is located outside the United States, who has U.S. legal training, might otherwise operate in a pocket that is not the same pocket that folks in the U.S. operate in. I will say, however, that due to the status of the general licenses and some of the changes, particularly at the end of in the fall of 2012, it's not clear to me that it's all that difficult to comply with this from a lawyering perspective in the United States or as a U.S. person wherever located.
Okay, that's great, and thank you, Andy. Before we move on to our issue involving the Iran transaction regulations, I believe Lindsay has a question.
Thanks, Clayton. Andy, this is all incredibly important information, and I think we all, as immigration lawyers, need to be aware of it. So I'm wondering, what sorts of things would you suggest that attorneys include, if they haven't already started including them, in their intake questionnaires so that we are able to advise petitioning employers that they have to think about this issue long before we send them that I-129 form, you know, and ask for that check mark in the box?
Let me unpack that. An intake questionnaire from who?
Well, the intake questionnaire from the immigration attorney. You know, sometimes this even comes up, I would say, in the initial consultation stages. And, of course, we're always going to ask about citizenship and nationality of anyone who, might be transferred to the United States in a non-immigrant status. But I think we need to start to consider perhaps how companies are owned as well as how they're doing business.
I apologize for unpacking this more, but are you asking who is your notional theoretical client here?
Lindsay is asking about a pre-engagement when you're talking to the potential client here before the client ever signs on the dotted line.
Fair enough, because it was more in the context of the I-129, and that's why I'm a little bit confused, because I-29 would be more in the context of, for instance, advising the U.S. employer as to what to think about for someone who they might sponsor under like an L or an H-1B.
That's what I mean. Let's think about this for a moment. We have, our usual questionnaires that we provide to employers or perhaps to employees when they come to see us, and consider also that in immigration law we have that unusual aspect of dual representation often. What sorts of questions should we be asking so that this isn't a last-minute thing,
I'm going to flip the question though, if it's okay, and then you can follow up. I think that any time you represent someone outside the United States who might be a client of yours, there are any number of U.S. international regulatory compliance concerns that can impact you as a lawyer, it would be wise as a practitioner or a law firm to engage in some of the sort of routine background checking, not background checking in a kind of a conventional sense that you might think of, because I know that there's some state law rules on that in the United States, but more about running them through various U.S. government databases. So, for instance, from an OFAC perspective, there are restrictions not only on sanctioned countries like Iran, Sudan, Cuba, et cetera, but there are a variety of people around the world who are designated as what are known as SDNs or specially designated nationals. There are people who the U.S. government has identified as being associated, for instance, with global terrorism, narcotics trafficking, and the like. And so to the extent you're an immigration lawyer and you're trying to assist someone to come to the United States, make an investment in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're probably going to want to run their name through U.S. government database. So to speak, so that you're not inadvertently representing someone you shouldn't or someone who you would need a license, for instance, to deal with. So, as a U.S. lawyer, in order to represent an SDN or provide services to an SDN, you would need a specific license. So hopefully that answers the question.
Okay, well, I think that you've raised an issue that perhaps a lot of immigration lawyers might not have been aware of. This is very valuable advice to our audience.
Yeah, I think, yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, these issues pop up. You see them pop up at annual conference. I think a couple of years ago we sort of hit upon them, but I think it's always good to, you know, redirect them, particularly the makeup of our chapter, you know, given what we do and who we are. It's sort of, I think this sort of issue sort of plays, you know, very highly and well to them. Andy, you and I, before we went on the podcast, certainly wanted to, you know, we were trading back topic areas, and one issue that you wanted to bring up was a specific example involving, involving sanctions in Iran. So I wanted to sort of cede the floor here to you for the last bit of our podcast here before we wrap up on that issue.
Sure. There's something, as I'm sure that a lot of your audience knows, called an EB-5 investor visa, and that's something that's sometimes created a bit of controversy with respect to Iran and Iranians. And there were some changes to the U.S. sanctions regulations effective October 22nd, 2012, where, in essence, OFAC promulgated a new general license set forth in 56505 that allowed U.S. persons to engage in all transactions necessary to export financial services to Iran in connection with E-2 and EB-5 visas. That actually has opened things up a bit with respect to investor visas, because prior to that, there was a requirement to get a specific license for the financial services component, at least, of getting an EB-5 visa. Because in other words, to be an EB-5 visa, you have to make an investment in the United States, and there were issues about where the money came from, how the money could be sent in or out, things like that. In essence, the new provision says that as long as you're complying with Section 56516 of the Iran transaction regulations, you're going to be okay from a financial services perspective. I believe it even allows the money to be returned to the extent that the visa is actually rejected. Note, that means that it would appear possible now to act as a lawyer to get someone an EB-5 without getting a specific license, conceivably at all. Now, of course, if there are things that you would need to do beyond pure legal/compliance work, or beyond the financial transaction in order to get the EB-5, then it's still possible that a specific license would be required for that bucket of activity. But so as you can see, it's kind of a tricky area, but there has been some movement, which I think is relevant to the folks on this audience about investor visas involving Iranians. So I know that's fairly nitty-gritty, but it actually is one of the more interesting recent developments for folks, and it really operates at the intersection of the legal services exemption and the 56505, not exemption, general license, and the 56505 general license. Clay?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you very much, Andy, for that.
I thought I lost you for a second. I was trying not to spout on too long.
No, that's okay. No, that's quite all right. I thought I hit the mute button, but that's, you know, there are little hiccups here in our podcast, and I guess, you know, we'll leave that in as part of our bloopers. But
no, it's more fun to have a little bit of playful banter.
Yes, true. Exactly. So Andy, thank you very much for that. I was saying off of the Netherlands that we could go for perhaps 3 days on these issues as opposed to just 30 minutes. But it's good to get a primer on these issues here. And so I thank you very much for your time, for your generous time here, not only today, but with a few with the preparatory phone calls and the prep emails here. You certainly went above and beyond, and as always, Andy, you're excellent technical lawyer, but also a very good professional. So we really appreciate that. To close out here, this has been a primer on OFAC and the export control regulations for the overseas U.S. immigration lawyer. I'm Clayton Cartwright with our special guest panelist, Andrew Irwin, along with Lindsay Kershaw and Claire Nelson. As mentioned in the podcast, but to remind everyone here, the information that's given in this podcast is not meant to be taken as advice for any specific situation or any specific individual or person. Thank you very much, and have a very good day.